This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. This week on the Compass, we see the birth of a grassroots wildfire, and we learn how transportation can be seen as the circulatory system of community. So now, let's go inside the Compass. Eight-year-old Debbie Steele is endowed with a warm charisma, the kind of fertile imagination that years ago led her to create the wildly successful Wearable Art Show as a way to fund another of her inspirations, the Fund for Women and Girls. But more recently, that same magnetic personality has landed her in a pivotal position in the maelstrom of grassroots political activism that has followed the election of President Donald Trump, a movement that has recently started to gel under the name Indivisible. I met up with Steele one recent morning at one of her favorite haunts, Pip Is Real Tea in downtown Port Townsend, to ask her how the movement got started.
Back in December, I got an email from a friend of mine saying, do you want to go to the Women's March in Seattle in January? And of course, I and many others replied, yeah. So we started getting so many replies that I said, why don't I check into a bus? We ended up taking four buses and 191 people to the Women's March on January 21st. So because of that, I had this big list of people, and they kept sending me emails and saying, what are we going to do next? So we decided we would meet at Sunrise Coffee. I sent out a note to these 191 people and said, this was like the 1st of February, maybe. A few of us are going to meet at Sunrise Coffee to talk about next steps. Join us. I walked in the door and there were 40 people there. It was a surprise to see so many people. And I didn't intend to really lead the group. And I still don't think of myself as the leader as much as I think of myself as just the person that kind of organizes us to get together so each of us can lead. So we met there three times. The second time, and thank you, Bill and Sue, for letting us meet at Sunrise Coffee for three meetings. And then they said, you know, this is too big for our little spot. So we had to move.
By the third meeting, about how many people showed up?
I'd say 50. Largest group we had, we went to Rosewind after, and there were 70. And Rosewind also said, this is a little too big for our capacity. So around the second meeting, we divided into work groups. Everyone felt that they weren't happy with the administration, and they wanted to make sure that our voices were heard, that we wanted to make a difference. Me particularly, as you know, since I started the Fund for Women and Girls, I was particularly interested in women's rights and women's health care. Other people said, you know, that's good, but I'm really worried about this immigration thing. And Ian Keith said, you know, all of those are good, but if we don't change how we're voting, it's never going to be any different. And someone else said, well, you know, if we don't get out and talk to people who think differently than we do, how will we ever be able to understand why this happened? So based on those conversations, we divided up into work groups. So we now have six work groups. Six and a half.
We have six and a half. What's the half?
Well, the half is We the People. It's a group started by a woman named Kathy, and Kathy wants to go out into the community and start conversations. She'd like to go out and meet with people who think differently and just listen. The other group is Immigration, very strong group led by Libby Palmer, and they're doing lots of things and hope to actually become their own 501c3. We have an education group that's small and is looking for more people to get involved. For example, there's a House bill that just came out, 610, that could destroy public education or dismantle it as we know it. Linda Martin is chairing a healthcare group, which is a big thing, you know. We originally started thinking of women's healthcare, but then...
I understand that President Trump has called it complicated.
He said, it turned out to be a little more complicated than we imagined, although none of us imagined it to be easy. But So we're working towards writing our senators, writing our congresspeople, making phone calls, showing up at meetings, and just taking action. Then at one point, Marty Gay started an indivisible Facebook page. And at this point, we're just still doing emails. I have a communications group, Stephanie Sale and Nyla Dart, and the three of us were sending out emails and also started a MailChimp. So it was a bigger newsletter. So now our newspaper's in color and lots of pages, and so it looked really good.
How do people sign up for that?
Well, that's what's happened. We're now up to 400 people because people would say, how do I sign up for that? They send me an email or hello at Stephanie's, Stephanie Selle, or DeborahKSteele@gmail.com. If you have a copy of our email, at the very bottom, there's a place that says sign up for this newsletter. And we also just started a website. But Steve, it is so brand new that I don't know the website address. But so we met with the Indivisible Group. They held a meeting. About 100 people came. They came to Northwest Maritime Center. Marty Gay and Michelle Sandoval chaired the meeting. Lots of people got up and spoke. And one of the things I kept hearing was people saying, I don't know what to do. There's so much. Every day I wake up and there's a new thing. Oh, my God, you know, which is how we felt after the march. And that's why we decided to do work groups, because I don't want people to be discouraged. We may have to do this for 4 years. And so we can't get discouraged. And both Patty Murray and Derek Kilmer and Mike Chapman and Steve Theringer and Kevin Vandewig, they have all said, keep doing it. Keep calling. Keep writing. Keep contacting us and letting us know how you feel, because it's working.
I understand that actually Congress has never seen the volume of mail and communications that they're having now. I mean, like the Congress switchboard is overwhelmed every day with calls coming in.
I've heard the same thing, and it just makes my heart sing. I also have heard that several people have turned off their phones because they were overwhelmed. Not good, in my opinion, you know. But I guess I didn't know what else to do. So after the Indivisible meeting, we received a lot more people saying, we'd like to be on your mailing list. And some people came and joined our work groups. We also do a monthly here at Pippa's Realties, where our tea is brewing here. The first Sunday of every month, we do a postcard writing party here from 3 to 5. We bring postcards. You know, we all have postcards in those drawers that we never write. We got them while we were on vacation. They're pictures of, you know, the Grand Canyon or something. Bring those. Everybody always has enough to share also. And we provide stamps. And, you know, we have a little bucket. Throw some money in the bucket to help us pay for the stamps. And we all get together and write postcards. And it's really fun. You walk in here and it's dead silence because everybody's scribbling away, writing postcards for whatever item that's particularly on their
heart. Do people come prepared with talking points or suggestions for people to, things for people to write?
Yes. Karen Rudd is in charge of the postcard writing party, and she always comes with a list of addresses and a list of items, just things that are crossing our inboxes every day that are pertinent at the time. The reason we're writing postcards is at the town hall we went to, that was another part of our group that said, you know, we need to show up at these town halls. There were 600 to 700 people in Squim that night. It was fabulous. Lots of positive signs and positive energy. And one of the things that Derek said is, letters take 6 weeks because of the anthrax. They still have to go through all that. So he suggested emails and postcards and phone calls. So that's one of the reasons we're doing postcards.
So who thought up the name Indivisible? Do you know where that came from?
There were a group of aides and people who had worked on the Hill, as they call it, in Washington, D.C., and they saw what the Tea Party did and how successful they were and how they made a huge difference in our political process. and change things. And they said, you know what? We're going to learn from that group. They sat down and they put together an it's called Indivisible, a guide to overturning the Trump administration. And they talk about, don't sign petitions, they don't do any good. Don't send letters, they're not read. Make phone calls, show up at town halls. They said how to show up at town halls. They said badger your congressperson until they do a town hall. That's their responsibility. They're supposed to do that. Show up, ask them pointed questions. Hold the mic until they answer your question. So they gave a whole lot of really detailed information. It's a 26-page document that you can get off the internet. And it was introduced by Rachel Maddow. So she introduced it on her show, and the next day it went viral. So that's where the Indivisible came from. It's techniques that were used successfully that we need to be using to make our choices heard. The Huddle title came because after the Women's March in Washington, D.C., said they were going to do 10 actions in the first 100 days. The first action was the march. The second action was asking people to gather huddles in their neighborhood to talk about issues that were of importance to them. Our huddle just turned out to be a little bit bigger than a neighborhood huddle. So
that was in response to that.
That was in response call. To that. And we registered on the website and since we were meeting at that time at Sunrise Coffee, we registered as Sunrise Huddle. So when we sort of merged with some of the Indivisible people, we decided to change our name. And we are now PT Indivisible Huddle. So those of us who huddled didn't want to lose huddle. And Indivisible wanted to be specific because there's also a Maristone Indivisible and a Ludlow Indivisible. So there's lots of them. There's Indivisibles in Squim and Port Angeles. So.
And across the nation, I imagine.
Across the nation, yeah.
I mean, do we have any idea how many chapters of Indivisible there are at this point?
No, I don't. But I suspect a whole lot, because I think what happened is we were sleeping. I was sleeping. I should speak for myself, Steve. I was sleeping. I was so thrilled with the president we had, although there were things I didn't like about the administration and what they were doing. I would have wanted them to be a little bit more assertive. And yet, so many of the things I truly believe in were passing. So I didn't do anything. So when this happened, and it's so fundamentally against my value system, that I felt like I had to do something. And I hear that over and over. I hear people that come to our meetings saying, what can I do? I'm so frustrated. I'm so bewildered. I'm so disappointed. And what I hope we're doing is changing that point of view. We're saying, what can I do to help? I want to be here to make a difference. Hand me a pen. Who do I call? And all of those things, I think, are helping me personally and the people that come, because I think when we do this in numbers and we see that we're making a difference, it gives me hope. When a Republican senator says, I'm being hounded by all these women, it gives me hope. So I think that's part of why we gather, to give each other hope, to cheer each other on, to say, wow, what are we doing next? Or Libby Palmer said, let's do a stand-up at the post office. There were 70 people that stood out there with signs and people driving by honking and saying, We don't agree with this immigration policy. We are a welcoming country. We have always been a welcome. That's what the Statue of Liberty is all about. This is not who we are. So those things give us all hope.
One of the things that I have not heard you mention is the dismantling of the Environmental Protection Agency, the reversal of, the denial of climate change, and the pouring of major new resources into the military while, cutting back on social services, all of which I would imagine must be issues that Indivisible is working on
yes,
as well.
Yes, and I apologize to Sherry Mann, who is leading the largest work group we have, which is the environmental group. They are huge. They are active. We are putting together a group. There's a group of led by Sherry that are going to Washington, D.C. for the environmental march. And there's also, she's putting together a group that I'm going to help carpool to go to Port Angeles to do a march in Port Angeles. I think doing a march near the national park is really emblematic and important for people to see that we want to protect these kinds of things. And Sherry and her group are working really hard in that particular area. I also wanted to tell you that we meet every other Tuesday. So we're meeting, the next two meetings will be at Unity Spiritual Center, which is, for those of you that have been around a long time, it's the old roller rink.
Right across from the Blue Heron School, yeah.
Yeah, 3819 San Juan Avenue, 4:30 to 6. We're trying to get younger people to come, so we're easing it a little later so that young people coming from school, we'd love to get high school kids starting on this environmental stuff. We'd love to get them interested in civics. Young families to come if they can.
That next meeting of the Indivisible Huddle once again will be at 4:30 p.m. on Tuesday, March 21st at the Unity Church of Port Townsend, which is located at 3918 San Juan Avenue across the street from the Blue Heron School. With Fund for Women and Girls founder and grassroots organizer Debbie Steele, this is Steve Evans for KPTZ Community Radio News. In more than 25 years of political involvement, transportation has been both a binder and metaphor in the search for social perfection that has characterized the career of Scott Walker, the electrician and one-time Port Townsend City Council member who, as the longtime chair of the Non-Motorized Vehicle Council and also as chair of Sustainability Group Local 2020's Transportation Lab, which recently changed its name to Transportation on Tap, to suggest that it might be fun to drink beer while talking about the social issues wrapped up in transportation, is the man who is the most directly responsible for Port Townsend's web of walking trails and bicycle lanes. David Tilk is a local educator who has joined forces with Walker and Local 2020 to do the same. The two of them are the architects of a community meeting this week to consider the interface of community and transportation. I met with them a few days ago in Walker's home to talk about that interface. I started by asking how Walker had become involved with transportation issues.
I saw how transportation affected the kind of place I want to live. I grew up in a place where I could walk everywhere and ride my bike everywhere, as was common in the 50s and 60s. And I wanted to hang on to that. And I also saw that...
Was that this place or where was it?
That was in Appleton, Wisconsin, which is still there. It's now known as the Fox Cities. It's grown into a megalopolis.
So the town you knew is...
The town I knew was walkable and bikeable and had good transit. And I think that those things enhance the kind of community we live in, as opposed to, in my opinion, having lots of car traffic and lots of car noise and... lots of car dependence. I think we're better off choosing a transportation system that's more bike, pedestrian, and transit rich.
And Dave, how about you? I mean, you know, what brought you to transportation as a interest?
Well, I might start by saying I grew up in Detroit, which is the Motor City. But I did notice when I came to Port Townsend 29 years ago that people actually use their cars more here in a smaller town than they did in Seattle when I lived. I mean, an average trip in town was almost always car driven here when I first came. And I guess I started riding bikes when I was very young. And even though, you know, I grew up in Detroit and it wasn't a very bikeable town, I used my bike quite a bit. And I guess I'm just thinking back. For me, I think I was in 10th grade on the first Earth Day. And I've been thinking a lot about climate issues and burning of fossil fuels and overall personal health ever since then. I think it was 1970, maybe 69 or so.
I think it was 70, the first Earth Day.
Yeah, I think I was in 10th grade. I should also say this. When my wife and I came to town, We talked about living in the city versus living a few miles out of town. And I've had a lifelong desire, and I still would call it somewhat of a dream, to live in the country where I have lots of privacy and quiet and I have more nature. But I didn't choose that route. I chose to live in town so I wouldn't be so dependent upon a vehicle. And so it was a big decision when we came here. And we gave up some things that we wanted, we really wanted. And we don't regret that, but after we got to know the place, Port Townsend, we were just amazed at how many people just drove around. It's changed now. There's more people on their bikes and walking than there was when we first came. But I have many friends that live out of town who are always saying, we want the speed limits raised on Hastings. We want the speed limits raised on Discovery so we can get in and out of town more. And I'm thinking, you know, come on, you know, I chose to live here. So give me that peace that, you know, that of less traffic and slower speeds. So anyway, I've been pretty much a utility rider since the age of 10, and certainly in Port Townsend. And I do travel when I can't, even as far as Chimicum, stuff on my bike for day trips. So that's kind of my thing. But I also think that it's really hard, but not impossible, in smaller communities to really focus on the public transit system. I think there's a lot that could be done with that too, to help us here. So
our central purpose of, you know, like having this story appear this week on Compass is that there is a big event coming up on Thursday evening, right? Scott, could you tell me what that is?
We are looking to start a conversation in the community about the intersection between transportation and community values. So we've invited 7 people from different walks of life to present how transportation affects their view of what is important to them in community values. And we haven't primed them. We haven't asked them anything other than that simple question, how does transportation affect your community values? Each of the speakers is getting about 7 minutes, 7.5 minutes to speak, which will take up the first hour. And then we're going to take comments and questions from the other attendees. And following that, we want to collate those answers and find out what people think, where they lie in this, begin the conversation, and hopefully come back a month or so later with another step to take on this journey.
So who are these 7 people and how are they selected? How did you pick them, Dave?
So we tried to develop a sort of a cross section where we don't really have an agenda in terms of outcomes at this point. What we're trying to do here is broaden the conversation. The city has part of their planning department. I'm sure they address transportation issues. And of course, Jefferson Transit has their component. But I know from living in the community that there are many people that have a lot to say about transportation systems and community values, but they're not really engaged in those conversations actively. So this first step really is the first step at broadening the conversation about transportation and community values. So we chose people that we felt had something that were in touch with themselves enough to know how they felt about their own values and community values and how transportation relates to that. So we've chosen, starting with Evan Ross. He now lives in Portland, but he grew up here, and he owns a company called Bicycle Portland. Mm-hmm. We have Sarah Doyle. She's with North Olympic Salmon Coalition. She's also on the board of the Recyclery. So there's 2 bicycle folks there. We have David Engel, who's the former superintendent of Port Townsend School District. He's a very big advocate about grappling with climate issues, climate change, and also somewhat of a bicyclist. We are a little bit weighted, it seems like, on bicycles. We have Margaret Lee, longtime activist in Port Townsend, a senior. We have Vern Garrison, a former city council person and developer, who spent at least as long as I've been here. He's been here quite a long time. Who am I missing?
Jack McCreary.
Go ahead.
Jack McCreary, who is confined to a wheelchair, and he has a viewpoint of transportation that's a little different than the rest of us who can walk. We also have Tim Caldwell, who grew up here and was a former director of the Chamber of Commerce. So we, as I said before, we don't know what their perspective is going to be. We can kind of guess by who they are, but
So did you actually like give each of them any kind of prep at all, any kind of theme for the evening?
Dave? Yeah, actually, I can't remember the exact prompt, but it goes something like, you know, how has transportation systems that exist today affected your values, and how would you see your values changing if you could implement the transportation system that you would envision to be an ideal one? So they all had a prompt, something like that, maybe not the exact same words, and that's what they'll be addressing in their 7.5-minute response.
When I think of community values, I think of things like how often do you get together with your neighbors, and what kind of like quality time do you share? What kind of activities do you engage in with one another, and how deep are your roots in the community? I mean, how well do you know people in the community, and so on? So those are what I think of as community values. And so I mean, maybe you could elucidate for me, like what you see the intersection as being.
And I think many people would have, they might come up with the same things, particularly if they had lots of time to socialize and to interact with their friends. And I think that's a really important piece of community values. But I also think, for example, young working people might be looking for affordable housing as a community value that we would hold up and say, okay, how can we place our housing in such a way that maybe if I have a low income because the jobs that are available here don't pay that well, I don't need to have a car, but I still can have access to housing and get to my job really easily. So I also think of the fact that many people on the highway, if you get up at rush hour, I commuted out of town for a while. There's hundreds of cars that go out in the morning and that are streaming out of town and also coming back into town at the same time. The same thing happens in the evening. And it's because people are going out to work or coming into Port Townsend to work. So just job availability is a big part of transportation. People that support community values around a healthy environment but also want to promote tourism. How do we engage in advocating for tourism but also protect the environment, considering that really the only way to get to Port Townsend, you know, conveniently or even halfway conveniently is by personal vehicle, and that's going to be an internal combustion vehicle. So I think of community values like access to goods and services. You know, do we have to drive to Silverdale to be able to get things? What are some options? There's many things that I think in the broad picture that come into the idea of community values.
Another community value for me would be keeping my health, which, as we all know, walking or physical exercise is one way to reduce many chronic illnesses. And it gives me great pleasure to look around town and see a lot of people walking and bicycling. But I'd like to see a lot more people walking and bicycling to go to work, to go to play, to hang out with their friends, to go downtown and watch a movie. I also think there's great value in not having to drive to Bainbridge Island to go to Seattle if you've got an appointment, or drive to Bainbridge Island to take the ferry across so that you can go to the airport. That's a huge community value if we can find another way to get there. Peace and quiet in the neighborhood, safety for your kids. If you live on a street, like everyone lives on a street, but to know that it's safe for your kids to be out there in front of the house, on the street, playing basketball or whatever. The streets, previous to the invention of the automobile, the streets were for people. other community values? Gosh, I just love that we live on what is a beautiful waterway, Puget Sound. And I want to keep it that way. And one of the ways we keep it that way is to prevent urban runoff from stormwater.
So I see when we start thinking about the intersection of transportation and community values, we start thinking about just about everything. We're thinking about housing and all of our infrastructure and and social systems. So it sounds like it's going to be a very interesting and broad-scoped evening. So give me the particulars. What time, where?
It's Thursday night, March 23rd. 7 to 9 p.m. at the Quimper Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in the Fellowship Hall in the old sanctuary.
Okay, well, I want to thank you both. We've run out of time.
All right. Well, thanks for having us.
With Scott Walker and David Tilk, this is Steve Evans for KPTZ Community Radio News. This week's KPTZ Compass was written and produced by Steve Evans.
The Compass airs Mondays and Saturdays at noon, Tuesdays at 5 p.m., and Wednesdays at 10 a.m., exclusively here on KPTZ, the home of eclectic, authentic community radio. For the news team here at KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, I'm Steve Evans.